This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 217 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else.
That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within one day.
No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard.
Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right. Free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Outlander.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/Outlander. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Outlander.
So now we are, of course, going to be discussing episode 304 of Outlander season 3 of Lost Things. However, first, as we do during the season when the show's on the air, we are going to include your feedback for episode 303, All Debts Paid. And first up is Matthew P.
Hi, Simone Ginger. It's Matthew here again, just leaving some feedback for episode 303. As if my tweets haven't given away this already, I'm blown away by the episode. I've only just watched it once. I've just finished watching it about 4 minutes ago, and I just wanted to get my immediate reaction recorded. I generally think that's probably the best episode of Outlander so far. I think it raised the bar on the quality of the episodes. In terms of the acting, from what I would now say is probably, there were four leads in that episode. Obviously, one of them is now gone, which I think is really unfortunate, because Tobias Menzies is incredible. In everything I've seen him in, and I first saw him playing Brutus in the series Rome, and I thought he was stunning in that. Even in his essentially cameo role in Game of Thrones, I think he's amazing. And he's been incredible in this series. To see him go with both his characters, I think, is a real shame. He will be missed. But the character of John Grey, which again I know nothing about, having not read the books, but I was really, really impressed by his proper introduction. I know he was briefly in an episode previously as a younger version of himself, but his introduction in this episode I thought was amazing. I didn't see that coming at all. But when I look back at it now, it does actually make sense. But I will probably leave some more feedback later on once I watch the episode a couple of times. Use this as you will. I just want to leave some initial feedback. Thanks. Bye.
And now, Shelsey J.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Shelsey from Orlando, Florida. So, the breakfast scene where Claire is asking Frank to a movie starts so hopefully. They're laughing, they seem comfortable with each other, and Claire makes an obvious effort to reach out. And he could have taken it. He could have said, "Yeah, honey, that sounds great, let's see a movie." But he didn't. He chose to shut her down and refuse to let her in. It makes me wonder how many times that might have happened over the years. He keeps blaming Claire for not moving on, but the couple of times we've seen her take initiative, he's the one that seems to not be able to move past his initial resentment. At Brianna's 16th birthday and graduation, we see in just a few moments the separateness of Claire and Frank's lives, even when they're right next to each other. Then, there's Claire's graduation day. He had become so bitter. In their fight, he says he wanted to hurt her in front of her colleagues because she always embarrassed him. But I'm willing to bet that even if she never fooled anyone into believing they were happily married, I'm pretty sure she never tried to rub it in his face at any of his work parties. And I'd also bet that she was at every one of his work parties as long as her schedule permitted. Even the most deadbeat husband would probably at least attend his wife's graduation celebration. Not only did Frank invite Candy Sandy, that's for you, Ginger, to their home, he couldn't even be bothered to be with Claire on one of the most important days of her life. It all just seems to me that he kept accusing Claire of not being present for him, but he seems to have given up on their marriage a lot more quickly than she did. He would guilt her into staying because he wanted Brianna, but after the first year, I don't think he really gave her a chance to be close to him. And even still, after all of that, and even after threatening to take Brianna away, she really does still love him. Her line that that amount of time doesn't exist doesn't just tell Frank that he never stood a chance. It also tells him that it wasn't his fault. There's nothing he could have done differently to make her forget Jamie. It frees him to completely detach himself from her, even though that's not really what she wants. His death is really a mercy for Claire, because I can't imagine what would have happened to her if she had lost Jamie all those years ago, and then had Frank take Brianna away. I think it would have crushed her. And of course, now she's free to tell Brianna the truth and begin looking. And I know I'm out of time, but oh my god, I love John Gray! He's on my very short list of favorite characters, and I thought David Barry played him so well. And hey, maybe we'll get a spin-off series about the Lord John novels one day.
And now, Michael M.
Howdy, Ginger. Howdy, Summer. This is Michael from Shawnee, Kansas. I would like to begin by thanking Ginger for reading my comments from last time and for her beautiful singing. Now on to my comments for episode 303. We learned early and we learned often that Frank had an extramarital affair. I do remember hearing Summer say that Frank had cheated, but I will disagree with that. If it's in the rulebook that they can lead separate lives, then he wasn't cheating. I would penalize him 15 yards for unnecessary arrival of the mistress. However, beyond that, it was fair game. One of the changes that I thought worked very well in this episode from book to show was how old Bree was when Frank declared he was taking her to England. In the book, Bree was only 16, and I think Claire would have had not too difficult a time stopping Frank's plans if it had gone to court. In the TV show, now that Bree's 18, I think it's more Bree's choice, and I think that declaration made it more tumultuous for Claire. And now for my parting thought. Maybe Jamie had another motive when he declined Lord John's offer to have cats put in the jail cells. Maybe Jamie befriended one of the rats. Imagine him channeling his inner Michael Jackson and singing to his friend.
Been the two of us needed no more. We both found what we were looking for.
Next up, Melissa M.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Melissa from New Jersey. Oh my God, season 3 is amazing. Oh my God, it's amazing. It is amazing. Ah, and this episode was so amazing. Oh my goodness. First thing, Murta is alive. Oh my God, Murta. I couldn't handle it. Guys, he lives. He lives. He lives. And I love how I feel that Jamie and Murta's roles are now reversed, now that Jamie is like a caretaker and is looking out for Murta instead of the other way around, you know, with Murta being his godfather and everything. I love how he is the one with the tartan. It's just so symbolic. And, you know, as a book reader, you know, like I think back and I think about like how Mackenzie was a young prisoner who had the cloth and Jamie took the whipping for him. And so perhaps it was a nod that Jamie's sacrificing himself to protect Murta, the one he loves, you know, his kinsman. I don't know, but I love that Murta lives. I do. I love it. And if he continues to make it and live to the colonies, which I think they kind of hinted at when Lord John Grey and Jamie were having dinner together, maybe he's going to stay alive. But I was just happy to have him in this episode because he's amazing and I love Murta. I'm just so happy. So yay, Murta. Yay, Murta being alive. The second thing is Lord John Grey. Oh my God, Lord John Grey. I did not know that I would love that character because I've read the books. I don't really love him. Like throughout the series, I'm like, meh, all right, he's cool. But, oh my God, I just fell in love with him tonight. He is amazing. He's just David Barry is just an amazing actor. He's just so good. And he and Sam Heughan together, oh my God, they're just so good. I couldn't even handle the scene between him and Jamie, where Jamie recounts where he met Lord John Grey and he asked Lord John Grey to fulfill his promise. Just the acting and the chemistry between them as actors was just so amazing and just so nuanced. So, I am so excited for more. I think that they are just amazing on screen together and I love it. I'm so excited. Quick note on Frank. I was shocked that they took the open relationship option. I have never hated Frank more than I did in this episode. I really did. I did not like him. However, I did cry when he died. And Claire's tear falling on his face when she sits with his body, it ripped my heart out. It was more than a tear prick.
Andrea P. writes, "This was definitely my favorite episode of season 3 so far. All the performances were brilliant. Myrta is back. Frank is a cheater pumpkin eater. Jamie is looking the best kind of grubby someone can look in prison. And Lord John is so charming and eloquent. He is Wesley from The Princess Bride in appearance and demeanor. I kept waiting for him to say to Jamie, as you wish. I agree with Summer that Lord John's character was not a favorite of mine in the books, but I think I will really enjoy his portrayal on screen. They really played out the story well with Duncan Kerr and, shall we say, perhaps leading up to a certain reveal. And did you notice that Claire was wearing white in every scene? Was that to emphasize the La Dame Blanche persona, or does it symbolize her chastity through all the years? And Frank, come on, he can't just go to her graduation dinner? How many female med students could be graduating that year? This is a momentous occasion, and he can't go celebrate that as a family? The writers really have made a choice to portray him as a selfish, passive-aggressive jerk in the end. It is admirable that he stayed to help raise Brianna, but to have affairs, then still do things to take revenge on Claire. And ultimately, threatening to influence Brianna to go away to England. It was only Claire's touching goodbye that could leave viewers having any compassionate feelings for Frank. I am so done with you, Frank. Bye-bye. Since I binge-watched the first 2 seasons, following along with the podcast this time around has been so fun. I love all the passion everyone brings to Outlander in the viewings and read-alongs. Thanks again for doing the best podcast out there." Very kind of you to say, Andrea. We do our best, and there are many wonderful podcasts out there, but thank you so much. We appreciate it. Next up, Melinda.
Hi, my name's Melinda, and I'm calling from Leapers Fork, Tennessee. I was just calling about, clearly, Outlander. For season 3, I really think that this is going to be the season of Sam. He has been amazing in the first 2 episodes with hardly a paragraph worth of dialogue in 2 episodes. He's amazing. He can communicate without words. I think they're doing an excellent job. The first, you know, the first half of Voyager is nothing but Sam or Jamie. So I think that Starz is really doing excellent script work this season. Well, all the seasons, but I think they've been able to sum everything up, you know, kind of paraphrase everything so that the viewers are able to see what's going on and what's been going on and see Jamie and Claire's struggles without having to put in every single detail of the book. So, I don't know. I love your guys' podcast, and I just felt compelled to call in and say, excellent work. Loving the new season. Can't wait till the next episode on Sunday. You guys keep up the good work, and I hope you all have a great day.
And now it's time for Laureen.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Laureen from Towson, Maryland, and I'm calling to talk to you about the fact that Claire seems to have only been wearing white in the last episode. Her blouses were white, her suits were white, and I can see my mother wearing all of them. But I was wondering what everyone thought. Now, Terry Dressbach, as according to Kim Downing, says, there was no zero white witch ideas. I was really upset when Frank said he was being discreet. I mean, who says that? And who doesn't go to his wife's graduation dinner? And that whole thing about Claire not being a good actress and no one thinking that they are happily married. I mean, who's not acting happily married? Come on. Anyway, that's my thought for the day. I'd like to hear what everybody else thinks. Bye-bye.
Christy G.
Hey, Ginger and Summer. This is Christy from Southwest Kansas. Just wanted to call and leave feedback for this most recent episode. I'm not a book reader. I am a show watcher, so I'm not familiar with any of the books, so I don't know what's different from the books and what's different in the show. But I have to say, I was so excited to see Murta. I was watching with my husband and I heard him speak, and the second word I was like, oh, that's Murta. My eyes just got huge and I looked at my husband and he didn't get it, but I was like, ah, oh, Murta. They kept him. I just wanted to reach through the TV and give him a giant hug. I was so happy to see him. So I'm glad that they kept that, or I'm glad that they changed that rather. Just want to thank you guys. I'm so glad to have found your podcast. I love listening to you girls. You are hilarious. Keep up the great work. You guys are awesome. Thanks so much. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Let's hear from Kim T.
Hey guys, this is Kim Taylor from Beaver Dam, Kentucky. I'm a first-time feedbacker, but I've been listening to your podcast for about 3 or 4 months. I just wanted to give some feedback on the last episode of Outlander 303. What I really liked is the story feels like it's speeding up for me, and it's not as slow as it was previously. We're getting to see more Jamie and, you know, really getting into the end of the story where we'll be able to see, you know, them coming back together, Jamie and Claire. So I really love John Gray, and I really liked how his character is portrayed on the show. I think the young man who's playing John Gray is doing a really great job. I also liked the scene with Jamie and John Gray as they're playing chess, and, you know, he reaches over in that moment of, oh, I went too far. You know, overall, it's been a really good season. I think 303 is my favorite episode by far. And I'm really enjoying your guys' podcast. Bye.
Now it's time to hear from Julie.
Hello, Ginger. Hello, Summer. My name is Julie, and I'm calling from Montreal, Quebec. I wanted to say thank you for your wonderful podcast. Outlander has been part of my life, I guess, for 20 years. I started reading the books in 1997 while I was in college. Now I'm a professor, and I'm still reading the books, and I'm enjoying the show. So it's something that I've always cherished kind of privately. But when I found your podcast, I just kind of found this sense of community that I never really experienced before. And it's really nice. It's really enjoyable. So thank you for that. You guys also brought me back to almost liking season 3. The first 2 episodes were, I don't know, felt a little bit disjointed to me. And I was disappointed, but listening to your comments, to your analysis, and listening to everybody else's comments kind of made me see them a little bit differently. So I'm kind of reconciled with episodes 1 and 2. So far, episode 3 has definitely been my favorite, and I'm looking forward to hearing from everybody and hearing from you guys and going along with the rest of the season. So thanks for everything again, and talk to you soon. Bye.
Kim D. writes, when I first saw episode 303, I was kind of on the fence. I didn't hate it, but it just fell short for me. Days before the episode aired, I saw the article with Ron saying that Murta was alive. I wasn't sure how I felt about it, but then when Murta did appear, it just seemed so anticlimactic. With Frank and Claire, I was mostly disappointed by the last big fight, but it wasn't as epic as I thought it would be. Today, I watched it for the 4th time, and all of a sudden, it clicked. I liked it. Things made sense, and I was able to keep the book out of my head. I paid attention closely to the actors' facial expressions, music, and so on, and it was really a good episode. As for the suicide by Warden scene, it dawned on me that Matt Roberts was probably trying to draw a parallel between Wentworth Jamie and Ardsmuir Jamie, and what was going on in his head. At Wentworth, Jamie pled with BJR to honor his promise to kill him because of what happened between them and because Claire was gone. He didn't even want to live the short while it would have taken to be hanged later that morning. It was too much to bear. At Ardsmuir, Jamie was hoping that Lord John would honor his promise to kill him after he didn't find any evidence of Claire on the island and the knowledge that she was not just gone, but truly gone. He didn't want to live anymore with no Claire. And there were also the differences between the two British officers, Blackjack and Lord John, with their relationships with Jamie. Both times, Jamie was denied that death he so desperately wanted and is forced to live. Fate has bigger things in store for him. I can't say I'm looking forward to next week, the curse of being a book reader and all, but I am looking forward to see what you all have to say about it. Thanks, guys. And now, We'll hear from Joanne.
Hi, Ginger. Hi, Summer. This is Joanne, and I'm calling from Birmingham, Alabama. And I wanted to leave a couple of comments about Outlander 303. This is my first time to do this, so please bear with me if I stumble. I absolutely love this episode. The writing is just out of the park, and it really brings clarity and depth to what we saw of Bree and Claire's relationship at the end of the last season in Dragonfly and Amber. It just adds so much more to that. I can't wait to go back and watch that episode again. And I have a new appreciation for Brianna now. I do have one little quibble, and that is about Duncan Kerr. What did he die of? Because he was a pretty healthy and robust fellow striding down that road when he saw the redcoats. Now, I don't know how much time has elapsed from the time that he found to when he died, but it did strike me as just a little bit contrived. I love your show, and I look forward to all your discussions. Thanks so much. Bye.
Here's Deborah.
Hi, this is Deborah S. Just wanted to say I loved last night's episode. First, I want to refer back to a comment I made last week where I said, it's only 6 years, and how are we going to get through the rest of them? And what I meant was I was being mindful of spoilers. I wasn't talking about all the books. I was talking about the years of their separation. But I'm very happy that last night's episode 303 was really sped up. They're just going through everything very quickly. Very happy about that. And what did I love about last night? Oh, my God. I love John Gray. I love that moment between the two of them. It was played with perfection. His little tear in his eye and Janie's immediate turn to, you know, you better stop or I'm going to kill you. That was great. I just love that. I love Claire's hair. I think she looks absolutely beautiful. And I don't know. I'm just really happy. It's just moving along, and I can't wait for you know what. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Next up, Cheyenne.
Hi, this is Cheyenne, and I am a first-time caller to you guys. I love the podcast. I started as a show watcher. I binge-watched the first two seasons, and then I read the first three books. So this is actually the first season where I have knowledge from the books going in, so it's a little bit of a different experience this time. First, I want to say I died of excitement when I heard Murtagh's voice in Ardsmuir, and I love the change. However, that excitement quickly died by the end of the episode when they were separated and we were separated from Murtagh once again. So who knows if we'll see him again. That definitely pulled on my heartstrings a bit. I did have a lot of feelings about Frank in this episode. I thought that their fight before he eventually went away and ended up in his accident was a lot less impactful than in the books. I pictured more yelling, and I did know she said some things about Bree and him not being her father in the book. And this one I felt was more of an emotional discussion. However, I do think this one's a bit more heart-wrenching because I didn't take a stance on the cheating for the show. I feel like he found something in his research that led him to believe that she goes back. So he's trying to get away from her so they can both find their happiness because he finds out that they go back. As for the books, I'm not sure what Frank's doing yet. I haven't read them all, but I just want to leave some feedback. Thank you. Bye.
And Sarah V.
Hello, my name is Sarah. I'm from Chile, South America. I love your podcast. I wanted to say that I loved how David Berry played Lord John. I think he showed very well his sense of honor, his love for Jamie, his inner goodness. I think he did a great job, although they had to compress so much of the story for episode 3. The first time I read about Lord John in the books, I loved him, especially because I was kind of shocked because the only LGBT characters in the story were so negative, especially Black Jack Randall. So yeah, Lord John is hands down my favorite character. Yeah, good job, Outlander series. Good job.
Marlo R. writes, I wanted to say how I totally agree with Summer and how completely bae Lord John Grey is. how amazing David Barry is playing him. It was so cool to see Lord John on screen. That little smile he gives when they are discussing the sauce. Are you kidding me? Adorbs. Lord John is one of my favorite characters, and one of the main reasons I love him is because of the way he is always taking care of, saving, or looking out for Jaime. Even sometimes when Jaime doesn't want it, and never asking for anything in return, he realizes that what he wants, Jaime cannot give. The way I see it, is kind of like a guardian angel for Jaime. We saw in Dragonfly that Lord John giving the information to Jaime in Coriarric when he was but a wee lad, he stopped Jaime and the Highlanders from even having to go to battle with the English, which could be seen as saving him from possible harm. Second instance is the very literal saving of Jaime's life by Lord Melton, which was done to repay John's debt of honor. The third time we see it in this episode is when he helps Jaime heal. Just by talking and sharing his own pain, Lord John helps Jaime heal his pain. Jaime speaks Claire's name for the first time. We see him smile, his voice changes, he almost laughs, and a light shines in his eyes. Healing has begun, though not complete. It's a start. John also saves Jaime from a long trip across the sea, which we know, due to Jaime's severe seasickness, he probably would never survive, especially in these conditions and with these companions. Instead, Lord John takes him to Hellwater, the home of a family friend, where he knows he will be treated well and he can continue to look out for him. Anyway, love you guys, love the podcast, love Jaime and Lord John, and the intrepid Lisa T.
Hi, lasses. It's Lisa T. I just wanted to give you my wee thoughts on 303. It was exceptional. Hello, Martel. That was great because it really gets us invested in the prisoners. Otherwise, it's kind of like, okay, that's really sad. He got separated for them. But with Martel, it's like, it's a rogue got lunch. That whole line that Claire had, oh, my God, there's no amount of time that exists. That was so heartbreakingly honest and beautiful and true and just brought it all back. And, of course, the play on the word time is really important. And then for the rest of this, I would just like to say I am in love with David Barry's Lord John. Oh, my God, David Barry, Lord John. Oh, my God, he absolutely just hit it out of the park. That whole moment when he and Jaime, when he's, like, touching his hand, I just fell in love with Lord John. So anyway, those are my wee thoughts. Lasses, have a great week. Thanks. Bye.
Next up, Jasmine C.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. My name is Jasmine, and I'm calling from Arizona. I am a book reader and show watcher. This is my first time connecting with you all, and it's a pleasure. I really loved episode 303. This was what I needed. Claire was beautiful, and Frank was dreadful, and Jaime was tragic and wonderful. They dressed Claire in all white, which was a wonderful stylistic choice because it was an ode to her Madame Blanche persona, and it was perfectly executed. They also brought Murtagh back. I thought this was brilliant because we have such a great connection with him through the show. How it will all pan out, I'm not quite sure, but I will say I was definitely emotional and maybe teared up a bit as they were taking Murtagh away and Jaime was going the other way with Lord John. They didn't shout, "I love you, man," but I felt like they would have if it were something Highlanders in the 1700s would do. When we see Murtagh holding the little piece of tartan fabric in the prison cell, it reminded me of the wedding episode. Murtagh was the one who brought Jaime borrowed clothing from a grieving widow for Jaime on his wedding day, and although he seemed incredibly inconvenienced by the errand, you could tell it gave him great pride to do this for Jaime. Murtagh is our rock, and we love him. Lastly, I wanted to share that I thought this was one of the most significant parts of having Lord John Grey introduced in this episode. Besides the fact that he's a crucial character, I appreciated how the showrunners really highlighted Grey's role in helping Jaime choose life. Jaime has been in a sad, tragic, and lonely place the last few episodes, and we see him wanting to die. He says to Rupert on the battlefield, "Leave me here." He says to the British soldier, "Shoot me." And then lastly, we see Jaime say to Lord John Grey, "Make good on your promise and kill me." But Lord John Grey says no. So now Jaime is seemingly out of options until Grey gives him the opportunity to do something different. Grey gives him the option to live. And I'm so glad he did. He served this very vital purpose in the show, and I cannot wait for the next episode. Although I'm already cringing. Thanks for listening to my thoughts and have a great week.
Finally, we have Amy D.
Hey, Ginger and Summer, this is Amy D. I'm going to start with what I wasn't super thrilled with, and that was the way that the show changed the narrative between Claire and Frank. I didn't like that they had an arrangement that basically meant Claire gave Frank permission to have affairs. I much prefer the way that Diana wrote it, where his adultery was ambiguous and we were never really sure, even though it was heavily implied that he had had affairs, and Claire just chose to look the other way. I think that her in the show basically giving him permission to go out and cheat was a disservice to the characters themselves. Also, the way that they changed the age of Brianna in the last argument that Frank and Claire had, I think it was much more effective and much more true to the story and to the characters themselves to have Frank basically demand to take Brianna, who was still a minor and still had not finished high school, with him to the United Kingdom when he took the job in Cambridge. I think it really drove home how distant he and Claire had grown in those years that they had attempted to maintain some sort of farce of a marriage. I felt like that these changes, more so than any other in the show, kind of toyed with the essence of these two characters, particularly Frank, but also Claire. It made her really unlikable, and I don't necessarily care for that. So anyway, those were the things that I didn't love. However, there were so many good things in this episode, and the one that I wanted to highlight with you guys was the moment when Jamie pulled the milk thistle out of the pouch or wherever he had it to help treat Myrta's rat bite. Immediately when he pulled it out and Duncan said the line about not more of your thistle, I knew that it was about Claire, that it was a memory of Claire. And when he pulls it out and he starts talking about crushing the leaves and the stems and how it'll help with the rat bite, and he says he learned it from a lass who knew a fair bit about healing. Not only was that a really touching moment and something that gave me a tear prick, Ginger, but also I thought it really spoke to the idea that Jamie really respected Claire and he revered her and he believed in her and in the gifts and the abilities that she possessed. And she was empowered in the 18th century because of the way that her husband believed in her and respected her, which is something that she was sorely missing in the 20th century with Frank. Even though she'd completed medical school and was now Dr. Randall, he couldn't give her the same respect and reverence that Jamie did in the 1700s. And I thought that that was a really interesting way to show that contradiction in this episode. Love your podcast, as always.
Okay, Summer, are we ready?
Are we ready? All right. And with that, it is time to move on to this week's discussion of episode 304 entitled Of Lost Things. This one was written by Tony Graffia.
And just right there, we stop and mourn a little bit because, you know, she's going to kill you in one way or the other, emotionally.
Well, you know what? Totally. And, you know, I was going to say,
a big hesitation, but
I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why, because I was thinking about it. And at first I was like, you know, nothing murdered me like faith. But after watching this numerous times now, I would say on the fourth viewing, the episode got me in a faith way. That we don't have to go into now. There's a whole episode to talk about, but because it's right at the end.
It's very easy to see why, though.
But it is, and it's almost in the exact same way that it got me. Mm. Just different circumstances, but so yeah, I think as much as I like Matt Roberts's episodes, they don't affect me on a cellular level the way that Tony Graffia's do. And I don't know if that's just because she speaks to my soul in some way that you know Matt doesn't, or maybe it's just the subject matter of the episodes that lends itself to breaking the robot. But yeah, no, this episode I was doing great. There are several things about this episode that I find completely and utterly and wholly distasteful and disliked on many levels, but there were some things that touched me in places that I wasn't ready for.
So are we ready?
I'm ready. Go.
Okay. So as Summer said, this is episode 304 of Lost Things, or I think the entire, and I mean entire episode, the Jamie part, not the 20th century part. I think the entire episode is the equivalent of the chapter, I forget the number, in Voyager. The chapter is called Geneva, and that tells you everything right there. So the opening title is, again, at least the sound, the music is a harpsichord. It's a similar sound that accompanied the dinner that Jamie had with Lord John Grey. Here we see some hands, presumably Jamie's hands, whittling a wee sonny for Willie, which we find out at the end, of course.
It's not that wee. Like, it's always bigger than I think it's going to be.
It is. The writer, as Summer said, is Tony Graffia. And as soon as I saw that, I'm like, oh, that's it. Let's throw the towel in now. I'm lost. No hope. She's just too much. Yeah, well, of course, we had to go forward and watch it. So we begin in Scotland of 1968, the 20th century.
The return of Roger Mack.
And I wrote, whoa, that was fast. Let's get our bearings. Okay, remember the end of 303. Last time we were with our beloved cast, Frank had just died and everyone had paid all their debts. Now we're in Scotland with Claire, Brianna, and Roger. And they're trying to get a handle on just where Jamie might be, if he's still alive. Find him, actually. They find him in Ardsmuir Prison, and just like in the book...
Can we talk about that for a hot second, though? Because it felt like there was a lot of exposition leading into, it could be difficult to find him, we just don't know where he is, we have to find him in this time period, and da-da-da-da-da, and then within, like, seconds, Claire finds him.
Except that they made a point of saying they had already looked through all of these prisons' registers. So they were getting toward the end. So they tried to, that's exposition, you're right, but they tried to like get that out in the first minute or so.
It just felt real fast. Like it didn't, I know that book-wise, it took them a while to find him. And she found him late at night by herself looking at books while everyone else was asleep. Or Roger might have been awake, but Bree was definitely not there. But it just felt... It felt really easy in the course of this episode for them to find him the first time, at least.
So just like in the book, it's Claire who finds him, but we're interrupted by Fiona. So she's still got a hankering for our Roger.
Poor Fiona.
Now, did anyone else notice that Jamie was lucky number 7 on that roster?
You would.
I know, because I have a thing for 7s.
You do.
Ardsmuir closed in 1756. So let's remember this date, for the TV series at least, since we now have Murta. So since Murta has hopefully survived his trip across the sea to the colonies, we need to do the math to see how long his indenture will be. So I didn't actually do the math, but it's 1756 when everyone was either sent off, or if you're Jamie, you go to hell water.
You go to hell water.
And then 14 years?
It was either 14 or 15.
Okay, so yeah, approximately 14 years. So I didn't do the math, but that's what? 56 to 66 plus 4, so 70. Good grief, that's a long time. So then we go to Hellwater, England, 1756. The Dunsanies arrive in style. We meet Jamie's new masters. And the music here is once again more of a classical style. And there's a string and it sounds like what the instrument that I had known of. I never played it during undergrad because I learned about it. That's all. I never played it. And then was reintroduced to the instrument by Bear in one of his blogs when he talks about the instrumentation he uses. And this is, the viola da gamba.
I would just like to say that in this scene, they introduce what are my new favorite and my least favorite characters.
Oh, that's funny. Summer, we'll get to that. I want to hear about this. So what happens is a carriage comes up and out spills the Dunsanies, Lord and Lady Dunsany, and their two daughters, Geneva and Isabel.
My new favorite character, like, legitimately, she eclipses Jenny. I mean, Jenny and I are going to break up very shortly anyway, but...
Summer needs a new female bestie.
But I found my new female bestie. I think Isabel and I are like soulmates. I love her. I love the way this actress plays her. And I just, I love Isabel. And I love everything her character becomes. And, Isabel. And Geneva can, you know, just eat a...
Oh, Lord, there's a bicycle horn for you.
Done with her.
So the family is arriving back from a trip to Italy. Fancy. So Geneva, who comes off the as she exits the carriage, is quite morose. She's just not, she always has a dark look. And I don't mean because of her dark hair. She just never looks really happy.
She looks like something always smells bad.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And Isabel just, I think, naturally looks happier. She could be the character or it could be a combination of the actress and the character. But either way, it's just she seems much lighter. Now, Lord Dunsany wants a word with Jamie, who is now going by Mackenzie. And
did you chuckle when he showed up and said, "So, you're the Scottish prisoner"? I was like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Yeah, I love that Tony gave that to us. So Jamie doesn't stick out at all. Like, he has his hair all over the place. And the other ones are not necessarily all combed back and having wigs or anything. But he's definitely the at least his hair. He's definitely the most, like, unput together of the grooms.
This is my least favorite Jamie wig or hair, if it's his hair. And I think it has to do with the bangs. I don't care for the bangs. They seem to always be coming free of the rest of his hair and, like, spiking out and hanging in his face. And it's my least favorite hairdo he's had.
Jamie, we learn, is officially going by yet another name, Alexander Mackenzie. And he's known, well, yeah, okay, let's leave it at that. He's known as Mackenzie here. We learn that Lord Dunsany lost his only son, Gordon, at Prestonpans. And I respect his sentence. Lord Dunsany is definitely an Englishman, but he is a gentleman and he's also reasonable. He says to Jamie, "You were defeated. Our quarrels are bygone." But he says Lady Dunsany isn't the same. She can't stand Jacobites. And Jamie offers common ground in their discussion. He says he's lost two children. And so he, which is the truth, and he, I think that definitely goes a little bit, not that Lord Dunsany is already, like, reaching out kind of an olive branch to him, just kind of warning him about his wife, like, you know, just don't push it, don't advertise that you're a Jacobite or a prisoner or anything. And to this end, he tells Jamie that, look, I'll tell her that you're a groom and you'll get a little stipend. I'll tell her, I won't mention you're a prisoner, but don't forget, you are a prisoner. Then we're taken back to the 20th century, and Brianna and Roger are stuck somewhere, and they're either out stuck somewhere or they're about to go somewhere. And
the car was on the side of the road. They were stuck somewhere.
So they're out somewhere. And Roger, being a scholarly dude, is not, I guess he's not that handy. But Brianna is. So Brianna is mocking Fiona and her Roger crush. And I really like Sophie in that hat. By the way, she wears hats well.
This was true Richard Rankin nerdy delightfulness, which is awkward Rankin. Well, when she fixes the car, because, of course, Brie can fix the car, which shows her
upbringing.
No, it shows her ability or proclivity or her. It shows her natural affinity for engineering and making things and mechanical things. Yeah. And what killed me about this was not that she fixed it, was that I had to watch this scene like 8 times because I could not understand what Roger said. Because at one time it sounded like he said, "What do you weigh?" I was like, "What do you weigh? Why would you ask her that?" And then I kept playing and I couldn't understand it. And she just kept saying, "I'll think of something." And I was like, that makes no sense. I can't figure out what he said. And then I was playing it today again and I had my headphones on and I wasn't looking in the screen. And then for the first time after 8 times watching it, I very clearly heard him say, "What do I owe you?" And I was like, "Ugh, duh." I'm like, I'm an idiot that I couldn't understand that. But it took me like 8 times through. And I swear to God, it sounded like I at one point heard, "What do you weigh?"
I will say, living in Scotland for a year and dating a Scot for 4 really have opened up my ears. So I had no problem. But that's hysterical, Summer. So, of course, as Summer said, of course Brianna fixes the car. So that not only calls us to Roger's scholarliness, but also that Brianna has more up her sleeve than we may know. Now, Summer's right. I didn't remember that. That she's definitely more naturally gifted or inclined to fixing things and the inner workings of things. That's her mind. And you'll remember that. It's not really I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that she doesn't stay a historian. Put it that way. A history major, I should say. And also, this is what I wanted to say without giving too many spoilers away or any spoilers away. Now, Summer, I think, is more on track with regards to her abilities and her leanings. But what I immediately thought of was, think about her father. Now, of course, I don't mean Jamie. I mean, although she could have gotten that natural ability from Jamie, who knows? But think about Frank. Think about how she was raised. Just think about that. So I'm not going to say anything more, but book readers will know what I'm hinting at. Just remember that she is gifted with her hands and with her and her mind of certain things. We're taken back to Hellwater. The grooms draw straws to see who gets to take out Lady Geneva on her ride. So we are getting, besides the little look she has, the not so happy look on her face ever, we see right away that no one likes her.
What's to like, man? She's just unpleasant. Like, legitimately unpleasant. So, good job, actress.
Yeah. Oh, Hannah James.
Yes. Good job, Hannah James. I refuse to learn her name.
Oh. Lady Isabel overhears Jamie saying that Geneva could use a good backside blisterin. And he's like, oh, Lord, sorry, m'lady. And she's like, nah, it's all good. It's pretty much the truth.
She's like, you're right. I can't really fault you there.
Nope. And it's very poignant when she says that she comes down to admire the horses, basically, because he offers to, like, get her horse ready. She's like, no, I just came down to admire them. And Jamie's like, yeah, they're beautiful. And she says, but it's still, you know, I'm sorry that my dad keeps them. I am just sorry that my dad keeps such beautiful creatures in these locked up. And Jamie's like, oh, I've seen a lot of stables and your dad's are the best I've ever seen. They're lucky. And she replies with, a cage is still a cage.
And I was just going to, that was what I was going to point out. And I want to know, do we think that this is, that she's a feminist, like a budding feminist? Or is this just a comment on her standing in life or her desire to be more than she is and being trapped in this life and being forced to fit in a specific mold and follow through with the specific life path when perhaps that's not the path that she herself would like.
I can agree with all of that. I am definitely not anti-feminist, but I wouldn't call her a feminist. I do support everything else you said, though. I think she realizes that, like, she knows her sister is going to have to marry for money because they're family. And this is what, I don't know if it's, there might be a line or two that gives you a hint of something, but the Dunsany's are not really doing well financially. And part of the marriage with Ellesmere and Geneva was going to help their family financially. So, you know, unfortunately, Geneva was
the prized mare.
She was, but she was the sacrifice. They basically sacrificed her for their family. But in the same time, it gave her standing. And she didn't like the fact that he was really old. But she was, you know, she was not happy to have to marry him. But she seemed more... But she seemed okay with the fact that there was going to be, he was rich.
Well, it was the most attractive thing about him.
Exactly. So I don't necessarily think she's a feminist. Definitely not in even the early 20th century term.
Not in nowadays terms, of course. But I think it was, you know, like the beginnings of what it became. Not the feminist movement as we know it today, but it might be, you know, the undercurrents of the beginnings of that.
So I think what she said is definitely relatable to the horses, definitely relatable to her. And you know what? Even though we don't like it, we need to keep that in mind for Geneva as well. Because Geneva, her thing, which we're going to get to, she was definitely in a cage. And she was going from one cage to another cage. And the way she did it was god-awful and unforgivable. But seeing that she was being taken out of one cage and being about to be put into another cage, she at least did, these were her terms. And unfortunately, Jamie didn't have a choice. I mean, he did, but it would have endangered his family. So obviously he wasn't going to do that. But it might give you a little more sympathy, or I should say empathy, for Geneva, not approving it, what she did, but understanding that she was about to be taken out of one cage and put into another. So it kind of set me up for, you know, a little more empathy for her, even though obviously I can't stand what she did. So this is definitely reflective of Isabel's life, her comment that she made, and the feeling she has at the end. I'm getting a little bit ahead, but it's germane to this comment. The feeling, the look on her face, the feeling she gets in the end when she gets to escape and marry Lord John, you know, I don't think she's technically, according to that society of that time, it would have been another cage. But if you have to be in a cage, meaning you have to be married and you have to, you know, marry well and you have certain responsibilities, that's, you could do worse.
I have so many thoughts about Isabel.
Aww.
Because I started to think, if that is, if the life that she is being forced to live by society and everything and societal norms and whatnot was her cage, what is her idea of free? You know what I mean? I'm like, what she, and she's clearly admires Lord John, but I wonder if she didn't already know that he didn't like women like that. And I wonder if that was one of the reasons she wanted him, which made me think, go down a whole bunch of other thought rabbit holes. And this is, you know, none of this is provable. Diana would have to be the one to come in and say, no, Summer, you're being ridiculous. But if she knew about Lord John, and if that was a choice that she wanted in the marriage, that she wanted a marriage to someone like that so she wouldn't be put upon to have a, you know, an arranged forced marriage or to be a wife in all ways.
And don't forget, she just saw her sister die because she had sex.
What if she's not into men at all? What if she's, I'm not saying she's a lesbian. I'm saying, but there are plenty of people who are asexual, who are not into, don't have feelings one way or the other. And that's not a desire they themselves have in life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I had a lot of, I still have a lot of thoughts. I don't have any answers, but I had a lot of things that I thought about in the course of this episode.
I can't wait to bring that up in our after show because I want to hear what you guys have to say about that. Because that's all, you're right. It's all kinds of interesting.
And can we say just, I don't know if you're going to talk about this, but when she's talking about Lord John and how she admires him and Jamie says his passion is for soldiering.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, soldiering, is that code for buggering?
Oh, gosh.
She's like, he has a passion for soldiers. I don't remember the exact term, but it had to say funny. About passion and soldiering and being a soldier. And I was just like, meh, meh.
Well, Isabel's statement and of course, the joy that she has at the end about being able to escape, if you will, or escape one in her manner of escape, potentially. I'm totally putting these words in her mouth to marry Lord John and be with him. It also made me think this whole discussion about birds and cages and being trapped. It made me think about back to episode one and Claire when she sees the bird outside of the window. So she's not really free either, Claire.
No, of course not.
Jamie tells Isabel that he was in Lord John's charge for just over a year. Now, I don't think this follows the book timeline. I mean, it could. I thought John was at Ardsmuir for longer than a year. I know Jamie was at Ardsmuir under Quarry before John came. I know that.
What year did they have him showing up? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but he closed in 56.
I know that. I'm just trying to see if there's a date, if I wrote down a date. 303, 1956. 1955, Ardsmuir was his arrival. So it was a year. If it closed in 56.
So what I'm saying is I don't know.
You don't know if it's a book timeline.
No, that's exactly. I think it was longer, but I could be wrong. Isabel, we find, as Summer said, really likes Lord John. Jamie tries to dissuade her from thinking of Lord John as marriage material, but she says it's precisely because he's a dedicated soldier that she admires him so. And back to Scotland, 20th century. The hospital in Boston calls Claire. It's Joe! He's called about a patient and to find out basically when she'll be back. And he calls her Lady Jane. There's a patient named Harry, and Joe's surprised that Claire doesn't seem to want to handle the case. Now, I think she does, because you see her, she seems, it's a name she recognizes, because she's like, Harry? You know, she's like interested, like basically, what's going on with Harry? And we don't find out too much, but there is something that happens in the books. It'll be curious to see if they keep it. If it is kept, at least in the book, it's not revealed till Gobs, maybe even the next book, it's Gobs later. So this may be nothing, but it may be something. Who knows?
Can I just say that Claire's has the rudest phone etiquette ever. She didn't even really say goodbye. Like, she said, or she didn't wait for him to, like, catch up with the conversation. She was just like, yeah, let me know how it goes. Bye, Joe. And then, like, I got the phone and I was like, he didn't even say anything. She didn't give him a chance to say literally anything. Not, hey, hang on, or, oh, okay, I'll talk to you later, or bye. Like, he had no time to say anything. Like, she literally was like, okay, goodbye, bye now, bye, hang up. She pretty much hung up on him. It's like that person who they want to hang up on you, but they feel too nice to hang up on you, so they'll say goodbye real fast and then hang up, even though they really hung up on you because they didn't give you a chance to respond. So I vote she, bad phone etiquette.
We are back in Hellwater, and Geneva, we learn, will be the bride of a very much older man, Lord Ellesmere.
I didn't think he was old enough.
Not crazy old like it seemed in the books. He was definitely older, old.
Well, he didn't look old enough to be her grandfather, which is what she was saying. And I don't know if that was her being full of hyperbole, but I thought that her dad looked comparable in age to this dude.
Potentially, but her dad could have been an older dad because I think in the book she's like 16, maybe 17.
They cast actors that looked roughly the same age to play her future husband and her dad.
And as Lord Ellesmere is getting out of the carriage to walk inside, he sees Jamie, or he says about Jamie, "My God, if a child of mine had hair that color, I'd drown him before he drew a second breath." Nice one, Tony Graffia. And we learn also it's 2 weeks. Well, yeah, it's nice one. Number one, it's funny. But number two, just watch out. It's 2 weeks, we learn, till they wed. So it's a really quick courtship. Geneva's giving Jamie some kind of side eye right here as Ellesmere, as they walk into the house. And I don't know, I don't think I've told you this, but she's not a carbon copy, but homegirl Geneva freaking looks like Katrina a little bit too much. It's eerie. Oh gosh.
I didn't think so.
The way she holds her head, the way she holds her head down and then looks up with her eyes, her eye shape, her beautiful long neck, her dark hair, her coloring. I don't think she's as pale as Katrina, and she's not as tall as Katrina, but oh, my Lord have mercy. So Geneva goes out for a ride and chooses Jamie. No straws this time. Oopsie. He's kind of got to do it because she's his mistress, I guess. So they go out on their horses, and Jamie's not playing her games. He's just like, look, I'm going to accompany you. That's it. And she fakes a fall, or she does fall, but she fakes being hurt or knocked out. And he goes to make sure she's okay, and he picks her up. And she starts to laugh and just, you know, says, I knew you'd come to my rescue, basically like that. And he's like, ugh, no. And then he drops her straight into a mud puddle, which was awesome.
I was glad they kept the mud puddle.
Me too.
Just like I was with the shoveling shit.
And she tries to flirt. And that's what's so funny is like she tries to flirt. And it's just on the ride before she purposely fell, she's trying to flirt. She's like, what do you find attractive? He's like, step off, woman. I'm here. I'm working for you. I'm not going to like be your monkey, even though he kind of is her monkey. She reminds him, you have to do my bidding. And I wrote, well, that'll be what gets you killed, lady.
I mean, yes and no.
That's what
indirectly.
I'm saying. So what's funny is after he drops her into the puddle and she is shocked and like, you know, and he just keeps on walking. But she's entertained by this. She's surprised and shocked and not happy, I'm sure.
Come on, no one has ever dumped her in a mud puddle before. No one says no to her, ever. And that, I mean, that is to his disservice. If he'd just been kind of like everyone else, he probably would have, you know, been unscathed by this this misadventure, if you will.
So she's kind of, I don't want to say sexually, because she doesn't know what that is. But if she's not turned on, because I don't think she knows what that is at this moment, but she's definitely intrigued. And like you said, so and much more interested than she even was, because here's someone who refuses to obey her and who stands up for himself.
Well, and look, he created a challenge.
There you
go. She clearly likes being challenged. And it's like the new challenge is not only does he say no, but can I make him say yes anyway? So it's like he really did this. No, he didn't do this to himself. She did this, but you know, he could have mitigated it by not being so Jamie-like.
The next scene, Jamie and Lord John are playing chess. So we see their continued, I would say theme, their continued relationship that includes playing chess. And this is, again, straight from the books. It's so lovely. And they have a wee catch-up. So it's one of Lord John's visits. John is telling Jamie basically about his report card. He says that the Dunsany's are pleased with his work. And I'm giving you a report card, Summer. David Barry gets an A. He looks really good.
Where does ombre go?
His hair? I don't know.
Yeah.
And then, Lord Melton, Colonel Melton, Hal, otherwise known as Hal, or whom we'll learn it to be Hal, soon enough, appears with the two Dunsany sisters.
Oh my God, this interchange was so amazing.
He, of course, as John is, he is also a family friend of the Dunsany's. He recognizes Jamie, but doesn't call him out to his credit. And Geneva recognizes that there is something there that's not being said.
Oh my God, the line though, when he was like, Lord Melton, I would never have let him go. I was like, bah, meaning you would have kept him imprisoned. That was so clever, and it made me cackle. And they were like, I'm surprised he would be parted with it. But he was like, I wouldn't have let him go.
And Hal, I'll say it again, Hal's pretty cute too. You still don't see it?
I never said I didn't see
it. Oh, I think you did say, because I think I first commented on it during episode one, during Culloden, and you're like, I don't see it.
Okay.
So then the next scene, Jamie is literally shoveling shit. Geneva comes across him. She starts in on her threats and
boasting about her quote unquote merciful heart. Quote,
you're very fortunate. I have a merciful heart. Like, really? Okay, that heart was a bad, like, Boston or something. Indeed, Geneva. She blackmails him to come to her bed. She understandably doesn't want her maidenhead to go to that depraved old goat. And she mentions that Colonel Melton told her all about Red Jamie. A threat that his parole might be revoked and he would be incarcerated. But Jamie still holds out until she mentions Lallybroch. That is the one thing he has left, his family and his people, whom he must protect, or he still can protect, and he acquiesces.
Here's the thing, though. Legitimately, the way that they played this off in this scene, as opposed to the books, what the hell were they going to do to Lallybroch? Nothing. He's paid his debt to society. He's on parole. He's done everything right. There would be no reason for the army to send red coats to Lallybroch. Everyone's doing the right thing. They're all towing the line. Whereas in the book, there was a letter going back and forth that had seditious things in it. So it would make sense that her having that letter would make it incriminating for his family, but him just being at Hellwater, he's supposed to be there. That's exactly where they stationed him. Him being there and her knowing where his family doesn't do anything.
Yeah, I don't know why they did away with the letter, because it's number one, it's stronger, it's more incriminating, and it's a piece of paper. It doesn't cost a lot of money. I don't see. They would have had to have a call, because the reason, I mean, it still would have been incriminating, but in the book, the reason the letter is so strong is because we knew before she confronts him with it, we knew before that point that he was writing to Lallybroch. And he knew that, and he used they didn't even need to do the gypsies. They didn't have to mention them at all. The fact that he was somehow getting someone to take letters for him, that would have been a little bit of planning, but it's a little weaker than having the letter. It's done, but definitely not as strong. I agree with you. So Jamie goes, and Geneva's ready, kind of. I am amazed, by the way, how easily Jamie gets into the building, let alone her bedroom.
Right? Well, in the book, he climbed a tree
and went onto
and he just like walked in from the hallway like, hey, the butler let me in.
That's what I'm saying. So she's very pretty, but so much, I'm going to say it again, so much like Katrina. So Jamie tells...
I don't feel like, I think after three, this is the third season now, I don't think I've seen Katrina's nipples as much as I feel I had to look
they
at
were
Geneva's.
There a lot. Yeah. So
it was a lot of nipples.
He draws the line in one place and he says, after all this, no. You may have brought me here. You will not, after threatening my family, you will not call me the name that they call me. You can call me Alex. And then she says, you may disrobe. Oh, may he? he takes his time.
No. Cue the angry shoe removal. Like, he was like, that's like when I tell my daughter it's bath time and she doesn't want to take a bath. And she just like angrily starts throwing her clothes around and slamming things and going back. That was what happened. It was almost petulant.
And then he looks at her and he says, you can watch me if you'd like. Oh, Jamie, we like.
Well, it's not like I had any other options. The camera was pointed at him.
And then he turns and his back to her and removes his shirt. And she's shocked. It's almost like, obviously she's seeing a naked male for the first time, but it's almost like she's coming face to face with the fact that, look, you may have done this and you may be getting what you want, but this man has been through hell, literally, and he's a real person with a real past. And not, you know what I'm saying? Yes, he is her plaything he is her monkey because she got him to dance to obey her. But seeing that, number one, shocked because, you know, it would be shocked to, I guess, anyone, whether an 18th century woman or no, it would be shocked to see how much someone was brutalized. But to realize that, and this may not have gone through Geneva's head, but I had a thought that She may have realized just how much he'd been through. And she knew, even though she didn't think about it, that his own people were not the ones who did that to him. It was her own people. So
I also think she was having just a little bit of buyer's remorse.
Oh, very possible. She's like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know. Can I do this?
She's like, whoa, that's not what I was expecting. That's not how I envisioned this perfect maidenhead experience, maiden voyage of her maidenhead.
And the cock of her head here,
don't say cock.
Like Katrina.
She's a cock on her head.
So he touches her and he gives her an out. He's like, we can stop this now. But she wants to go forward. Quote, I want my first time to be with someone like you. Don't we all, Geneva? Imagine being Hannah James. Let's talk about the actress this actress, yes, but the actress doing this part. She literally has one job. Yeah, there's a few scenes leading up to this, but no, there's really only one scene. Could you imagine, like, and then you die and you never have to come back. So
you better hope you were having a good nipple day, because that's about
summer. No, my point is your entire role is to have on-screen smexy time with Jamie. That's your entire role, period. And then you die. I mean, that's like...
Well, she gets thrown in the mud. That happens.
I said there are a few scenes up till here, but this is it. Yeah. Come on. So when he is gently, kind of guiding her, coaxing her, he grabs her booty. And he like... That's the same... He grabbed Claire's booty. I wonder if that's a Jamie thing or a Sam thing or a director thing.
Could be all of the above.
Yeah, could be. So he says he'll take his time.
Well, Jamie's a butt man.
That's true.
Jamie's always been a butt man. He was always talking about Claire having a nice wide backside. Yeah,
that's true. She slowly starts to dig it. He removes her dressing gown and they lie on the bed. And I won't describe it more because, I mean, you know, you guys watched it and I don't love to get into these things, but it was pretty good. Okay, so he's in. The first time I watched it, I was waiting for her to start crying or screaming, and it never came. Hot diggity, they're not going to use the not rape. Geneva, you dirty birdie. She liked it. So let's talk about this for a hot second. What do I mean by the not rape?
You're not asking me, are you? I feel like
I'm not quizzing you.
This is like the worst. This is the worst class ever. It's like you're waiting for me to answer questions for you, and I don't need to.
Our listeners who haven't read the books will not know what I'm talking about. When I say they didn't do the rape thing, they're going to be like, what? If you've read the books, you know exactly what we're talking about.
Geneva tries to pull out at the last minute and he won't pull out.
Geneva tries to get him to pull out at the last minute and he won't. Yeah.
No, she tries to pull out of the entire event at the last minute and he won't pull out.
Yes. And so there's a big controversy about the books
as to whether or not consent can be taken back. Well, I mean,
it's, whether or it's not Jamie was situational. A rapist, let's just say it.
Right.
And it's huge. Summer and I talked about it when we talked about this chapter. I forget the number, but in our Voyager read along, it was a huge, we got a lot of commentary, a lot of contributions that chapter. And it's still a hot topic. I mean, like what, 20 something years later, it's a hot topic. I mean, I get it. And,
well, it's a hot topic because it's a hot topic in today. So it's, you know, it's something that's still, you know, for whatever reason, still society feels the need to not to be divided on it. And to, you know, when.
Well, the big debate is not about necessarily the big divide on this. If it were, I mean, yes, it's written by a modern author or a contemporary author. But the big debate is whether or not we can put 20th or 21st century mores onto an 18th century character. And that is basically the gist of it. And many people say it was. Many people say it wasn't. But
and I think this conversation right here is why they left it out.
I was just about... Okay, exactly. So was I... it's not that I wanted there to be more controversy. No. But we were all curious how they were going to handle this. Thinking, oh my gosh, what are they getting themselves into? You know, what are they going to do? And by completely going around it, they saved themselves. And it's still effective. So that's what I want to ask you.
I mean, the end result is the same.
Well, okay, in the book, there was that little thing, I want to stop, and then he didn't. He's like, no. Well, but after that, she got into it, and they did it a few more times in the book. So in the end, not only did she enjoy it in the book as she enjoyed it here, she still had a baby and still died. So yeah, it doesn't change the story one bit. And it actually can benefit you by avoiding controversy. So number one, were you surprised? Number two, were you happy?
I don't know, happy is the word I'm looking for. I felt, all in all, this scene was too long. I thought that for the season having been going the way that it has been, this has been the longest sex scene of the season. And it's my least favorite because of the background and connotation. And I felt, like I said, I felt harassed by Geneva's nipples at the end. I was like, I am so tired of looking, of seeing them. And it was just like, they couldn't have framed it any other way. It felt gratuitous to a degree. And this is the first time the show has ever felt a little Game of Thronesy to me. Because I didn't think it was necessary.
Well, in the end, she likes it and tells him so. And even says that she loves him. And of course, she doesn't. He makes a good point, or at least Diana does, that these afterglow feelings aren't love. He explains that this afterglow is something that anyone can create in your body if done right.
Isn't that like oxytocin?
That's what makes you want to...
That hormone your body creates that creates the closeness, the bond between people. You have to cuddle or it doesn't happen. So it's his fault.
So that's probably the best way to put it. Quote, love is when you give your heart and soul to another and they give theirs in return. Unquote. The look on, and I did notice it like the first few times I watched it, I was listening and watching, but I didn't concentrate on her face. But the last time I saw it, the look on her face when he says this end of that line, she looks crestfallen and like, damn, and like looks away. I was like, oh, well, okay. I missed that the first like four times. So after their night of passion, a married Geneva, so she's gone away, gotten back, come back married. She's married and comes back. So it's a while. It's like 7 or 8 months or something like that. A married Geneva comes home to visit her family. Heavily pregnant. Good job, Jamie.
She's so obvious. Like, seriously. She gets out of the cab with her bloated belly and like turns around and stares right at Jamie. I was like, come on, girl. Everyone's going to know. I mean, they're going to know anyway, but everyone's going to know.
And then we're back to the 20th century Scotland. Fiona brings Claire the Scottish pearls she'd given to Mrs. Graham. And the Jamie and Claire theme plays.
Can we talk about their special friendship?
Oh, yeah.
You know, usually that's code for something else in that time period. That would mean that they had a special friendship. That there was something else going on between Mrs. Graham and Claire. And, you know, I had a problem. It bothered me a little bit because I know on many levels that Mrs. Graham is her grandmother. But I thought Mrs. Graham was way closer to Claire's age than she apparently was, because
she was in her 40s or 50s and Claire was late 20s when they first met.
I guess. But Fiona is so close to Brianna's age.
Yeah.
That it struck me that I was like, she didn't seem like that she would have been grandmother age. But, you know, it's been a season or so since I've seen her. So
now these were Jamie's mother's pearls, right?
Yes.
So Brianna says that the National Museum has an extensive collection of ship manifests. They are planning to go look and to pick up Jamie's trail and see if he traveled anywhere by ship.
And no one has ever been that excited about ship's manifests ever in the history of ship's manifests.
Roger and Bree are sweet together. I'm pretty sure they have Brianna in a wig, or Sophie in a wig. It's a little too perfect of a hairline. Definitely looks different than when her hair was colored before. So they have a chat, and she is afraid of losing her mom the closer that they get to finding Jamie. So that's, you know, very understandable. And Brianna brings these things up that are true dangers of time travel. What if something happens to her? What if she can't come back? Well, those are huge possibilities.
I want to know who took Roger's jumpers away from him. That shirt was a travesty. I disliked that shirt on such a cellular level.
Roger is admitting he's sweet on her. Quote, "Part of me doesn't want to find them, because once we do, you go back to Boston." And then she kisses him. And that was a little abrupt. It was kind of cute. But I do love that they're in front of that fire. Man, I want to be in the front of that fire. Then we're taken right back to Hellwater. Isabel.
Every time you say that, I think you're going to stop at hell. We're taken right back to hell.
Summer. Isabel is running to find Jamie. They need the carriage quick. Her sister is in labor and it isn't going well. Then we see a gorgeous shot of Hopeton House, a stand-in for Ellesmere Estate. In fact, it turns out they are too late. Geneva has died in childbirth, but the child, a boy, is healthy.
Who feels like they were cheated out of a death scene?
You know, it's not that I necessarily wanted to see a death scene. It's that I remember those lines from the book and Isabel delivers them almost verbatim about how she was quote unquote fine, whatever that means, during the birth, and she was sitting up and holding the baby and laughing. That is directly from the book. I'm like, they could have done that and redeemed her a little bit more. You know what I mean? A little bit. But they could have done that and then shown her starting to lose, you know, starting to faint or whatever, and then just cut away. They didn't need to show her like dying, but oh man.
I wanted a full on death scene. I wanted her suffering.
Oh, she suffered. She died.
It might have been quick. Bloodlust does that. Sometimes you just kind of go.
To the music. All the time that they're rushing. So Isabel running to Jamie, the carriage making it to Ellesmere, Jamie walking around, finding out what happened to the baby. The music is harried and fast. Once Jamie finds out the boy has survived, the music slows. And Bear puts kind of a nice little final note to it right there. It kind of ends. Later on, Jamie comes upon Isabel crying in an alcove. She's devastated to have lost her sister. She's her parents' only child left. And she slaps Jamie a good one. She says Ellesmere knew the child wasn't his, and she knew too. Geneva told her they lay together. They had never shared a bed. Geneva and Ellesmere, and that Geneva was in love with him, Jamie. But Isabel, we find out, is a good secret keeper. Then there's more trouble. Ellesmere comes clean about the child. So they rush to the room where there seems to be something going on with Ellesmere himself. He knows, or he says, his child is a bastard. I wrote, "Wow, Tony." She writes, quote, "I'll not grieve for a woman soiled by the cock of another man." Woo! That's a line. So much of this, I don't think that line, but so much of this, of what's happening is straight from the book. It's heart-wrenching. Imagine the Dunsanys, distraught that their daughter is now dead. Their financial hope, her marriage to Ellesmere. She's not even cold in her bed, and here her husband is insulting her and threatening her child. Dunsany wants to shoot Ellesmere, but Jamie gets the pistol from him and tries to coax Ellesmere to give up his knife, which he has pointed at the baby. But he then moves to stab the child, and Jamie shoots him with the gun he had just taken from Ellesmere. I swear, it took me so many times to watch that and to realize, I mean, obviously the baby didn't die. They're going to be very careful. A baby wasn't hurt. But when he fell like that, oh my gosh, like the baby stayed in the crook of his arm. I'm like, really? That scared me. That baby like landed on the ground, but he didn't.
Now, that baby was cushioned by a meaty man.
That is true. Jamie saves the baby, picks him up from the arm of Ellesmere, and now this wee tot is the sole heir to his father's estate and fortune. His legal father's estate and fortune. For no one will speak against his paternity. Back at Hellwater, Isabel, still in black to mourn her sister, meets Jamie with the horses, Willie in a stroller. She says they named him William after her father. It's funny that Diana chose this, that Jamie's older brother was also named William. So she picks up the baby and shows him to Jamie. She apologizes to Jamie for treating him the way that she did. Just as she's putting the baby down, or just as she's holding the baby, some music starts. Isabel walks away and her mother, Lady Dunsany, approaches. While waiting for Lady Dunsany to approach, Jamie looks at the baby and shares a wee moment. Quote, "You're a braw laddie, Willie. You're so wee. Dinna fash yoursel. I'm here." We won't know for sure until Bear confirms it. But here I do hear a new bit of music, which I think might be a theme. It's very tender. And it's the oboe or the clarinet. I'm thinking oboe, because clarinet was pretty much Frank's. And Lady Dunsany comes to him and says she has good news. The coroner's court has determined that Lord Ellesmere met his death by misadventure. She knows that Jamie is a Jacobite, a former Jacobite. And Jamie says, "I hope you'll forgive the deception." Now, she does not answer this statement, but she goes on about her husband and his influence. She says she would be able to get him released from the conditions of his parole. Now imagine the words that he's longed for the past years. Quote, "Would you like to go home to Scotland?" Unquote. Now even when he was the Dunbonnet, literally next door to Lallybroch, he couldn't truly go home. And just as he says he will not, just yet, we hear the beginning of the Jamie and Claire theme. It's in the strings. It's a very soft hum. Now, what does this have to do with Lallybroch? Claire is gone. There is no more Claire. But Claire was his home. That's the only... It was very short, but it was something we've all heard. That's my only thought, is that because Claire was his home, too? That's the only... That's all I got there. So Jamie considers it. But looking at Willie, he knows he can't. What a decision. What a decision to make. And so he tells Lady Dunsany that he would like to continue sending money back home for a while. She says he may, but that when he's ready to leave, he has only to ask. Then she turns and takes the baby with her. As the picture fades to one of him and Willie on horseback, we hear just the beginning of that theme again.
Did you think that kid looked like him?
Not really.
I mean, me either. Thank you. I was
the
just
only
like,
thing I
kept
guess,
looking for it.
I don't think. I mean, thank God. Okay, they made him a brunette, so that's good. The highlights, whatever, may show up later on. Who knows? The only thing I can imagine they were going with is the deep set eyes. That's all I could. That's all I could think of. But no, he didn't look like Jamie much at all. I don't think or Sam.
And I know lighting has so much to do with everything, but I kept thinking his eyes looked brown because they were so deep set that I couldn't tell what color they were. And the two blue-eyed people are not going to have a brown-eyed baby. That's just not how
life works. Don't tell Jamie and Claire that.
I know. But who am I complaining about? The point is they kept saying that his eyes, he had his eyes. And I was like, really? I don't see it. But I thought he was adorable. Oh,
he was a heartbreaker. So
I'm not complaining. I'm not really complaining. I just didn't see it. But I thought he was adorable.
So it's almost like Bear was dancing with that theme, or the thing I heard that I thought might be a theme. And then as I said, the picture fades from that into Willie on the back of a horse or a pony and Jamie kind of directing them. Lady Dunsany is standing watching her grandson with a friend. And she jokes that Willie is starting to look like the groom. And the friend's like, you're right. And Jamie's like, uh-oh, someone needs to make a move. He looks closely at Willie and realizes it's true. It is time that he moves on. We go to the 20th century again. And they have looked at all those ship manifests, but they have no luck. And it seems that the place they're at, that library, they have all the ship manifests. There's nothing else to look at that place. And all of them are about a century too early. Claire's like, she's pretty much is like, I'm done. We haven't heard it yet, but she's done. So they drink. I mean, what else do you do? They go to a pub and they drink, where a woman is declaiming Burns. And she's being appreciated. You know, people are laughing at her, laughing appropriately at the right points in the Burns declamation. But they're also, Claire and Brianna, who are with Roger, are getting some stares at this pub. And we learned that it's really not appropriate at that time. Women weren't typically at the bar. Now, Roger is used to the research. He's happy to keep going. He's like, look, we can go to every single place. We can look at the manifests of every single port in the country. We can do this. This is nothing new to him. He's used to the search. That's his training. Claire's had it, though. Remember, she's not the historian that Roger is and that Frank was. And we learn that freedom and whiskey were something, as a Burns line, were something that she quoted to Jamie once. She says, it's time to go home. Jamie says the same to Willie back at Hellwater. It's time to go home.
I feel like she finally felt remorse for hanging up on Joe.
Willie is adorable. Willie says to Mac, this is your home. And he wants to go with him. You have to do what I tell you. I'm your master. And he has a little, you know, not attack. He has a little tantrum. And Jamie spanks him for his mischief and calls him a wee bastard. And at the way he takes that, Willie is not happy to have been called a bastard. So we get the hint, and this is from the books too, that he has heard that word before, and it's a very touchy, even at that young age, he's very touchy about, he's sensitive about that word. So Jamie takes it back. He apologizes. Right here, as they're saying goodbye, it's that same oboe clarinet music or those notes that were playing when he was standing next to him in the stroller. It's either Willie's theme or, okay, no, it's Willie's theme. At least I'm calling it that. I can't wait to see what Bear has to say. So obviously, he can completely tell me I'm wrong, but we've heard it two times here now, and it's always when Bear's with Willie. It's always when Jamie's with Willie. I can't wait to see what Bear says. So I want to know what he says to him in Gaelic. So we'll have to wait for Agav and or our good friend Mandy with her blog, Great Scott Blog, as she breaks down the Gaelic in each episode. Jamie returns to the stables where Lord John and Lady Isabel are. The two men have a chat. Lord John says that he'll miss his chess partner, but Jamie is right to go. Quote, we all have our secrets. Yours is walking around. Anyone with half an eye can see that. So apparently it's quite widely known or suspected. Right. Jamie wants to ask if Lord John will watch over Willie to serve as his father. And he even goes so far to offer his body to him. The look on Lord John's face is priceless. In the book, however, he bursts into uncontrollable laughter, which I find hilarious. And I wish they would have kept that because, I mean, it was a good reaction. And I love the line he said. He handled it well. That was what he was given. But, I mean, Can you imagine someone like bursting into laughter? Like, and then Jamie still reacted like, you don't want
that's
me.
Like, that's like every nightmare ever. Why do you think I've never asked man out in my life?
As many people, but he says, of course he says, no, I wouldn't do that. But as many people have pointed out, this was actually a test on Jamie's part. If John had said yes, there's no way that he would have, you know, supported Willie being with him. But we learn also that Lord John is to be married to Lady Isabel. Jamie's protective of her, it seems. And John, we learn, is fond of her, and he promises he will do right by her. And it has the added benefit of that he'll be able to care for Willie as a father. And Jamie tells him, you shall always have my friendship.
And perhaps my butt if you decide you want it later.
Jamie is making his final preparation for leaving, and he says a prayer to St. Anthony, or is about to say a prayer to St. Anthony, when in comes Wee Willie. Wee Willie wants to say goodbye to Mackenzie. And I love that they kept the stinking papist part. He educates him that it is not a heathen image. It is, in fact, St. Anthony that is there with the light, with the candle, and that he is the patron saint of lost things. He says that he lights a candle and prays for the ones he lost. And he tells them that his brother was also named Willie, and that the people he prays for are his sister, his godfather, and his wife. And this surprises Wee Willie. Willie's like, you were married? Or you had a wife? And just after he says, not anymore, the love theme sounds. So this is his only father-son talk he'll have with him. Willie says, I want to be a stinking papist too. Please, Mac, I want to be like you. So he baptizes him William James.
He's like, that's not my name. And then he says his whole name,
and we get the name Ransom. This is the first time we've heard that. And when he's all done, oh my goodness, the little boy, when he says, I'm a stinking papist now. And instead of a rosary, which in the book he gave him a rosary, he gives him a little sawney, which I guess we have to call a Wee Willie because the name.
Oh, we're not calling it that.
And he says, I haven't got anything for you to remember me. And Jamie is like, don't worry. I cannot. I will not be able to forget you. And then, like, right away, the song, Where Have You Been, My Blue-Eyed Son? Oh, my God. Really interesting choice for a song. I mean, almost a little bit literal. But just very sad. Fitting, oddly, but very sad. And this song starts as Claire, and that we go back. We see the 20th century where Claire is taking down all of the Jamie Hunt items and getting ready to go home. And back in the 18th century, Jamie says goodbye to...
Pull it together.
To Willie, Lord... Stop laughing, you... Jamie says goodbye to Willie, Lord John, and Isabel. Oh, man.
I was doing okay in that scene until Isabel walked up to hug him and said, we'll take care of your son. And that's when I started. And then with him riding away on the horse... And the devastated scene behind him and the devastation on his face. And
so as he, as he rides away, whew, interesting choice of music, like I said, but it was very hard. Lord John looks a little wistful too. And then going back to the 20th century, Brianna sees all the, I call it the hunt, the Jamie Hunt, sees all the stuff is gone from the walls too. And then back in the 18th, Willie breaks free of... Isabel and John and runs after Mac. This is all Tony's fault. Roger, we see, is reflective about the whole experience. Maybe, of course, thinking what he hinted at earlier about losing Brianna. And then they have Claire and Brianna, of course, are on their flight back to Boston. Claire is giving up the dream of returning to Jamie. And then I mean, seeing the boy run obviously was hard, but I think I lost it seeing Sam's face as he was riding away. Mm-hmm. His face, I mean, you could see it was just like his muscles were clenched.
Maybe he just had to fart.
Oh, Lord. So
I'm trying to get you to stop
in
crying.
In the last episode, oh, sorry. Okay, so Sam's face was so hard to watch. What a journey he had in this episode. And in the last episode, they close on Claire leaving the hospital after Frank died. This episode, they close on Jamie leaving Hellwater after it becomes too dangerous for him to stay. So, dear listener, let us know what you thought of episode 304 of Lost Things. Call our listener line at 916-587-0763 and let us know. Or you can leave us a voicemail on SpeakPipe, and that's at speakpipe.com/outlanderpod. And as always, join us to continue the conversation. And you can do that every day in almost every way in our exclusive Facebook community, and that's at outlanderpod.com/group.
So come back next time when we will be discussing episode 5 entitled Freedom and Whiskey.
Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.